I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is with former PGA Tour player Roberto Castro. Roberto was out at the Players this week, took in some of the action early in the week, and he came on to just talk about the 2022 Players, as well as we got into kind of golf development at the end of the podcast. Roberto is the co-host of his own podcast. It's called The Course Record Show. He dives into the business of golf. It's super interesting. He has a lot of great guests on, and it's a little bit different angle. It's very unique. I would recommend listening to that. You can listen to that on anywhere you get your podcasts. And he is also a senior advisor at CapTech, an IT consulting company that dabbles in sports, as well as the owner of Castro Golf Consulting, which does logos and different branding for golf. So we talk about the 2022 Players, which was quite an interesting and compelling watch, and as well as some other things. And without further ado, here is Roberto Castro. All right, another Players in the books. Roberto, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm just I'm hanging in there. It's early here in on the West Coast. I'm trying not to wake up the kid. You were out there early in the week. How was being a spectator at TPC Sawgrass?
Yeah, other side of the ropes. It's funny. My credential. I have a Korn Ferry credential, and it says inside ropes. And my colleagues in my new gig are like, "So you can just go under the rope at any time into the fairway?" It's like, no, you kind of just enter at the driving range and then you're inside the ropes for good. They just kind of felt like I could just go check out a putting green at any time if I wanted to. But it was good. Players was, the course looked unbelievable. It's such a bad break with the weather. But on Tuesday, Wednesday, it looked just pristine. It was teed up for a great week, but what a disaster weather-wise.
Yeah, I mean, it was... In a way, I think this is just something that I feel like I kind of liked the Monday finish, just because I think it was different for somebody that covers golf all the time. And like I had like a real Sunday night for a rare real Sunday night for me. But, you know, obviously always a bummer when you miss out on that primetime window. That being said, some of the weather I think made for awesome TV Saturday with that wind, while some players might have not really appreciated being sent out there. I think, like, you look at Kevin Kisner, he finished three shots short of getting in a playoff, and that's the exact scoring differential between the two waves. He had some pointed comments about it, but, you know, that viewing made for incredible TV with the wind and everything. And one question I had for you was, you know, as somebody, you know, the played on tour, played in three Players, is there anything that we can glean as fans from Saturday about Players, or was it just one of the like freak weather and the few guys who played well just had it that day? And it was just one of those days. If you don't have it, you look really bad. And if you have it, you look really good.
I would say people were reading into it a little bit too much, like the constant, you know, Justin Thomas's ball shape, his shaping his shots and his high and his low. I mean, he's one of the five best players in the world, whether it's dead still or blowing 40. So I think people were reading into it a little bit too much. But about the Monday finish, totally unexpected COVID outcome. What percentage of people are working from home now and had that on a second screen for 12 hours on Monday? Like every single person. And I know that, especially during Masters, that people get that screen going Thursday, but I bet the numbers were way up compared to a similar situation 3 years ago because so many people, especially golf fans, are working from home.
Yeah. Also, I mean, expanded coverage, right? You know, you have so much more ability to watch now. And I think like that's been one of the big revelations this year with the ESPN Plus coverage is like how much better the streaming options are for when you get these weird schedules is that like ESPN Plus, as opposed to like, you know, no shots at PGA Tour Live before ESPN Plus, but you watch that main feed now and it actually feels like a real golf telecast, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a balance, right? Because I think Justin Thomas, what he did was pretty incredible. Like some of the shots he hit, you know, the knockdown 3-wood or 5-wood, whatever it was on 18 that went from 206 was something that you just didn't see a lot of guys attempt. You know, him, he was one of the few players that I thought really hit the shot that was you needed to hit on 17, which was, you know, taking 4 extra club than you think is the right club, you know, based off the number and hitting that 6-iron and, you know, really flighting it down. I thought, you know, it's so rare that we see the best players in the world have to hit really different shots. Just because of, I think, how optimized everything's gotten, you know, with the spin rates so low with drivers and everything, that in a way it did expose some people, like, you know, that went out there and just tried to kind of hit like I think they were trying to knock it down in some regards, but just like did not have even like the weren't even in the right stratosphere of what type of shot to hit in certain situations. Right. People that maybe only hit one shape, like that high fade was not going to work on 17 at all. Like there's no way you were going to hit a high fade and have any semblance of success. So I think there was a little something to glean, but the reality is that we don't get these conditions very often. And, you know, what are the chances of them coming up in a major week is so low, right?
Totally. And I think you nailed it as far as weather dictates scoring and weather dictates the interesting nature of events. All this talk about setup and course design, you need weather. But I think the biggest takeaway for me was it showed what would be possible more regularly if the ball went 10% shorter. That was the biggest thing I thought of, was March versus May is going to bring in more weather in March, and this was an extreme case of that. But you had Jason Day hitting 2-iron sandwich into 18, and with this cold weather, which makes the ball go 10% shorter, you had everyone hitting driver off the tees again. Huge difference. Number 10, guys were hitting driver and maybe 3-wood and spraying it all over the place. Number 18, you saw guys in the right woods. You saw guys everywhere because they were hitting driver. And that 5-wood Justin Thomas hit, okay, extreme wind, but that hole's like 465. If he's hitting a tee shot 260, 270 instead of 310, there's a much higher chance you get to see 3, 4, and 5 irons. Some of the shots Kisner was hitting, like low bullet draws through the wind, you can get a lot more of that if the ball just went shorter.
Yeah, I think that it brings out skill. Like one of the things I was thinking about on Saturday when it was happening, you know, Kisner played really well. He had obviously, I think it was the fifth hole, or he made a double or a triple, if I recall correctly. I don't have the scorecard up in front of me. But, you know, he played a really great round. And one of the things I was thinking was, A, he hits a draw, which is a little out of fashion. Not a lot of the top players hit draws, which holds up a lot better in the wind. But B, the other aspect of it is Kevin Kisner is far more accustomed to hitting long irons into greens totally. On a regular basis. And, you know, it makes a big difference when, you know, if you're one of the guys like, you know, DJ or Brooks or, you know, insert long player, you're not used to, like, DJ recalled like vividly when the last time he hit a 3-iron, he had to hit a 3-iron into a green. And he recalled vividly the last time he had to hit a 3-iron. He's like, and they asked, you know, why do you remember it so clearly? Well, I don't, that barely ever happens. And right. I think you're right. Like the shot making that comes from the ball going a little bit shorter is so, and I think that's the thing that was everybody loves so much, whether they can get to that point, you know, extrapolate the point to where, like, what they loved about Saturday was that these guys really were challenged and had to hit different shots, which is, you know, which is great. Like, it's way more fun to watch, you know, a, you know, whether it's the, you know, NFL, a great offense go against a great defense than it is to watch, you know, a great offense go against the worst defense in the league. No offense to your Falcons.
Oh, none taken. Agree totally. My argument for making the ball go shorter has always been that I think it's more interesting to watch players hit 14 clubs. And that's what you saw. That's what you saw on Saturday. And it's kind of funny. You have the old timers that say, not only should the ball go shorter, it should spin more. Well, what did we see Saturday? It was cold, so the ball went shorter, and it was windy, which makes the ball spin a lot more. So it was like right there in front of you. Like, that could be possible. And instead of seeing driver wedge, driver wedge, driver wedge, and then a 240-yard par three where you get to see Brooks hit a four iron, it's the only time you get to see him hit a long club, you actually got to see it through the golf course, and it was great. It was great to watch. I didn't watch a ton on Saturday, but that shot on 14 that Kiz hit, that hole's 460, 470. Like, that should be a hole that you're watching guys hit four and five irons into. And he hit this rip hook through the wind to the back pin to like 20 feet. It was an incredible shot. And to your point, I think he's done that. He has to hit a couple four irons a day. And JT and Rahm and those guys never do. So it was cool to watch.
Kisner's like a perfect example of a guy, I think, like, of, you know, when you're a shorter hitter, to play at the level that Kisner plays at is so impressive. And it makes me always wonder, like, if the ball went a little shorter and being able to overpower a golf course wasn't such a prevalent thing, how much higher in the world rankings, how much more well thought of would Kevin Kisner be as a pro? Because when you look at his stats, he does everything extremely well. You know, he's accurate off the tee. He's a great iron player. He's a great putter. He's great. He's got great short game. But, you know, where he can't just bully golf courses like some of the better players, like Jason Kokrak can do, for example.
Yeah, what Kiz does is incredible. Kiz's game on the modern PGA Tour, he can legit contend in six or eight tournaments a year, and I don't think he would disagree with that. And then he does in four of those six. He finishes in the top 10 at RBC, the Players, Sony, Greensboro, almost every year. Do you know how hard it is to say you're only going to get six at-bats this month or this year, and you need to hit four home runs, and he does it? Incredible.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things, like, he's a, you know, it makes me think of, like, great pinch hitters. When you say you only get a couple appearances, it's like right. The guy that you can bring off the bench in the seventh or eighth inning, and he just, like, always figures out a way to get on base at those places. But one of the things is like, when the conditions are right, that's when he pops in majors. Like, and we've seen him be relevant in majors. He hasn't gotten it done. But what is it, Quail Hollow? If you know, when Justin Thomas had his one, he was in that in the mix there. And then, you know, he's a great match play player, which I think is, like, it's kind of telling. Like, he's a guy you wouldn't want to see, you know, playing, because he doesn't give you anything. But when you were on tour, I'm curious, like how much is weather the ultimate, you know, I need to use a lot of shots in my bag, or like, how does that work with, like, the balance of course setup and weather? Like, which carries the most impact to how different you could play a course?
I really think it's 90% weather driven, because the only other course setup factor is putting tight pins to firm greens. And then there's only one shot you need. It's high. Mm-hmm. And it's long, because so you can have a shorter club in. So if they set it up tough, 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 that just means tighter pins, firmer greens. All I want to do is hit it high and long. But when you bring weather in, there's a few different ways to get around the golf course, and which you saw on Saturday.
I think this was extreme weather, right? you know, that we aren't going to get a lot of this, but like it made me think.
This is a once every 20 years horrendous weather. Yeah.
It made me think that they should have a tour event at like literally the windiest locale in the country every year, just because of what type of shot making we got to see. And
they do. It's called Honda and nobody plays in it.
Yeah.
Because it's brutal. It's that we have that tournament. It's the Honda Classic. You're just signing up to get punched in the face.
Yeah. South Florida on a regular basis. It's just like, especially in March, it's just, you know, there are a lot of days you just don't want to even go outside to hit golf balls. So I asked you to prep a couple takeaways and I prepped some for also. And one I wanted to talk about, something I took away this year that I really appreciated. And some people would look at the leaderboard and say, oh, it was fluky. But one of the things I look at it and say is like, hey, at the Players, is this the one big tournament year in, year out where everybody really has a chance because of the golf course, where it's pretty equitable for all types of players?
Yes, but I think that there's two sides to that coin. Absolutely. It's the most it's the hardest tournament to predict who's going to win. I've been on record as saying that these major championships, there's like 8 to 12 guys that can legitimately win. For a few reasons, one being course setup, one of a few. But the flip side of that is I was at the golf course Sunday for a few minutes and there were like 30, 32 holes left. And everyone and their cousin was within two shots. And I was sitting there with a couple buddies and I said, two guys on that board are going to win this tournament, can win this tournament. Justin Thomas and Cam Smith. And they were like, really? All these guys are in it? Two guys. And I was right this time, not always. And Kiz was too far back, or I would have, he started the weekend 2 under. So I would have put him in that category if he didn't start so far back. So it just begs the question, like, what is it that at the end, the cream, like Hovland came out of nowhere. The cream rises to the top. Is it the money? Is it the pressure? Is it the lack of experience? But Cam Smith and Justin Thomas just stood out as the most accomplished, polished, nails down players on that board. So yes, everyone can contend at the Players, but what was the last fluky winner? Like we had at the Players.
I mean, I don't think Siwoo, like everybody would point to Siwoo, but I don't think that's a fluky winner. Like
no,
he's
I don't
done
think so
enough
either.
And like everybody's like, oh, he was like statistically he was having a bad year, but like you look at his career, it's like he was the youngest player ever to qualify for the web.com tour.
I agree.
Which was that it's like that's not fluky. You know, you looked at the leaderboard and you saw all the names that were on there and you saw a lot of like worst case scenarios for the tour is kind of what I always goes through my head. It's like I was there the year Siwoo won and I heard the groans of the media center that, you know, this is the guy that everybody has to write about. And but Cam Smith, like he's an interesting topic of conversation because he's now sixth ranked player in the world and is discernibly different than the five guys ahead of him in terms of how he got to six in the world, the style of play. I think it's unbelievable. I think he lost six shots to the field off the tee. He hit some really terrible tee shots, five shots. And you know, but at the same time, when you put a short iron in, I don't know if there's a player that in the world that I would trust more. And then just like in terms of demeanor and overall like personality, I think he's a lot different. He's a lot more laid back than a lot of the best players in the world are. And, you know, I think there is something when you're coming down the stretch is like certain guys just know how to get the ball in the hole, right?
Yeah, putters win. It's just another data point in putters win. Paul Casey's an unbelievable golfer. And the break he got on 16 was possibly the worst break I've ever seen in golf. He could have hit, the way he strikes a golf ball, he could have hit a 5-iron to a foot there. Instead, he barely makes par. But it's hard to win when you don't make when you don't make putts. And Cam Smith putts so well, and he chips so well. I played with him. He's the best chipper and putter I've ever seen. I played with him at San Antonio 1 year and the first 2 rounds, and he chipped in 3 times. And 2 of them would be a chip where you're just trying to get it within 20 feet. The eighth hole has a green that's like 50 yards deep with this tiny back shelf. And he had a 47-yard bunker shot, and he rolled it in like a putt from 40. He's incredible around the greens. But he's been nails. I watched a few of those President's Cup days when it was at Royal Melbourne, and you could tell that he was totally unflustered by the whole deal, knocking in 6, 8, 10-footers. I don't remember who he beat or didn't beat, but he's definitely elevated. But I agree with you on the laid-back part. He doesn't seem – I generally think and say that to be a top five player in the world, you have to sacrifice kind of your whole life. And those guys eat, sleep, breathe. You know, Rory famously said he had like 6 open days on his calendar a year. Cam Smith does not strike me that way, which is pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I think in a way it kind of helps him. I've heard that he's like super into pickleball, as well as obviously fishing is like, you know, and it just seems like he does his work. He's been quoted. I don't know the exact quote, but like I do my job and then I go enjoy life. And it's like, yeah. Oh, that's like, and I think like, it's like this idea, like everybody gets, and parents of junior golfers now are so focused on specialization. And Cam Smith, a really good example of a guy that was really talented. Obviously he was 21. He finished top 5 in the US Open. That's how he got his tour card. But at the same token, he kind of takes some lumps and a different path along the way. There were some, I think, people frustrated back in Australia about, like, why isn't this guy, you know, making it? And a lot of times, you know, the rumors were, oh, it's his work ethic. But balance becomes a beautiful thing when you figure it out. And all of a sudden, he's got something that a lot of people don't have, which is the ability to depart. And when things aren't going great, he goes out and does what he wants to do. And I think that, and who knows, the pickleball thing, maybe that helps him. Maybe, you know, he looks a little bit more spry this year than
he has. His reflexes are up.
Yeah. I was somebody messaged me. I was talking about this on the Shotgun Start. Somebody messaged me who's a very, very good player and avid pickleballer, who said, it's about being athletic at something other than golf, like that it really brings without huge risk of injury.
Yeah. Well, there is pretty decent risk of injury, but better if you're 28 versus 68. But yeah, putters, he proved that putters win. And then the last 2 weeks proved that at the end of a tournament, it always comes down to getting a ball up and down or making a putt. I know he stuffed it on 17 and the 4-iron he hit on 16 was unbelievable, but he gets it up and down on 15, and then he hits that great 4-iron on 16 after snap hooking it. And Scheffler, the week before, he gets it all up in the bunker there on 16 at Bay Hill, gets it up and down from 50 yards. It always comes down to a wedge shot. And on 18, obviously, I'm forgetting the obvious one. Cam Smith knifes it up there to a foot from 55 yards, like it's no big deal. The winning comes down to making putts and getting the ball up and down. It always does.
When you watch somebody put together an entire round, the rounds that win are those ones that like make those key saves that keep their momentum. And I think with Cam Smith, it was the middle part of that back nine that was so impressive, where he wasn't hitting the best shots, but he was scoring at an elite level.
Totally. I know that the strokes gained approach stat is what everyone says is the golden stat. But what I tell the tech kids, the Georgia Tech guys turning pro, every day I'm more convicted in it. You need to be a prodigious driver or putter. It's one of those two. You can play the tour and have success if you drive it or putt it better than anyone else you know. And Hovland and Cam Smith are two examples of that. The proximity from the fairway or strokes gained fairway, if you're playing from 320 in the fairway every time, of course you have a good proximity. I think that's more the driver than it is the approach shots. And the putting, you know, is pretty simple, speaks for itself.
Yeah, I would agree too. It's like, and if you can drive and putt it well, then you have career years. Like that's, you know, I always pick on Jason Kokrak, but it's like he figured out the putter and he was a prodigious driver and he won three times in a calendar year. And it's like, oh, Well, that makes a lot of sense. It's like if you drive it and punt good, there's not a lot of courses that you can't play. And Paul Casey falls into this boat of what we would describe as underachievers. And I had a question for you. You hit on it. Terrible break. Horrendous break on 16. That being said, I think you can look at the way he played down the stretch, and it was very, very, very conservative with the shot on 17. And who knows where he was aiming. The way he kind of played 18 and the decisions he made on 16, he had hit a bad wedge. He clearly was trying to play that funnel in there, but you know, it reminded me a little bit of a Poulter a few years ago where he was in the mix, needed some birdies. He hit it right to the middle of 17 green. And I'm wondering, you know, we like to, as me in the media likes to poo-poo money. Yeah. This is the richest person in golf. Paul Casey walked away with over $1 million. Does money really matter coming down the stretch? Does he know, hey, if I finish top three, I'm making over $1 million. If I make a double here, it's going to cost me $500,000.
I don't think Paul Casey's thinking about that. I really don't. I think he's trying to hit the right shot. The disappointing shot was the wedge on 16. That not getting that one there, and you saw Sam Burns kind of throw it behind it. They said he can't lose it here. He can only lose it here. He's two back, and Cam Smith's going to make par. If he wedges that thing, gimme, how many guys have we seen make seven on 17? He could have easily won the tournament. But the wedge was disappointing. But no, I don't think he's thinking about the money. And on 17, every guy is aiming 10 feet left of that thing. And you block it a little bit, you look like a hero. And if you pull it a little bit, you look like you bailed out and you were playing for money. So I don't think that's – I'm gonna say no, he's not thinking about the money.
I was just curious. Like, at what point does money matter? Like, is it once you reach a certain point, say, I'm just going to arbitrarily pull a number out of the sky, but like arbitrarily, once you've made 20 million in your career, you kind of, it desensitizes it, or is there a threshold? Like, I imagine, you know, as somebody who, you know, once you get onto the tour, there's probably a shock about, I'm playing for $6 million. I'm playing for $8 million. Like, you know, do you think there's a point where you can see it, you know, certain types of players, just the money doesn't matter anymore?
I think so, but I would say it does not correlate at all to a number. And there's that quote that Cam Smith a couple years ago said that he's pretty much set. Well, he's pretty much set. You can win $80 million and spend 70 of it, and you're going to be thinking about that money. So I would say in the arc of a normal career, yes, you think about it a lot and then it pulls back. But I remember clearly my second tournament on tour was Palm Springs, and I teed off the back Sunday and I was like six, seven under, I don't remember, with two holes to play. And I was like up into like 25th, and I get on the eighth hole. And I'm like, my God, it's like a short wedge. If I make another birdie, I can make like $70,000. And I hit this 90-yard wedge 55 yards. Like, absolutely laid the sod over and finished like bogey par and made 25 grand. And yes, 5 years into my tour career, I would not have been thinking about that, the 70 grand, because it doesn't really move the needle 5 years in. But when you're 25-year-old rookie and someone's going to, you get to play golf in Palm Springs for 4 days and someone's going to hand you 70 grand, hell yeah, you think about it.
Well, I think that's why so many guys struggle the first time they get in contention. Yeah. Like what you just illustrated, and whether or not people can realize it, like if you're playing your club championship and you're thinking, oh, if I win this hole, I'm up three with six to go. That's the exact same thought, just in a different spectrum. And it's the absolute worst thought that you can have in a golf course. And that makes
it the absolute worst thought.
It's like, if this happens, then this happens. It's the worst line of thinking you could possibly have on a golf course.
And maybe that's the answer to my question earlier about, like, Sam Burns has more money than he can spend, and he's got an unbelievable career ahead of him, and he's nails, like college player of the year. He's incredible.
Yeah.
Maybe he's thinking about it. It's his first players, $3.6 million, raising maybe he thinks about it. And the first time he gets there, he kind of drove it bad all day. But I'm just pulling his name out of a hat, right? It has something to do with it, probably.
And maybe it might not be money for Sam Burns. It might be actually the career accolades, and it's moving him. I think a lot of guys, it's maybe not money, but it's what the win does for their career in terms of legacy. Like the players, we could talk about this, but like whether it's a major or not, it's not a regular event. You know, certainly not a regular event. It's a huge deal. It's something that your peers, like the way the collective golf world's going to think of you after a win there is different. And I think that is there are two things, the money aspect that, you know, you for certain guys, but then for the most guys, it's really that legacy that is the big pressure that hangs over them, not to steal Paul Azinger's term, but you know, that's the thing that kind of weighs on you on a Sunday is the idea of almost like, and it's like there are classes of players on the PGA Tour, and a win at the Players might leap you a class or two, depending on the player.
Totally, totally.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Elijah Craig. Every player has their own unique style of play. That's part of what we love about golf. It also happens to be what we love about bourbon. Like Elijah Craig, for example, every bottle of their award-winning small batch carries a signature warm spice and subtle smoke flavor. I like to drink my Elijah Craig on the rocks. It's my go-to at the 19th hole. There's also a lot of great cocktails that you can make with bourbon. I highly recommend personally a Moscow Mule, but substitute the vodka for some Elijah Craig bourbon. Elijah Craig won the double gold at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition last year. It goes to show that hard work and dedication lead to great things. Whether you're watching this week's Valspar, last week's Players at home, or playing a few holes with your buddies, make Elijah Craig your signature sip. Discover greatness within ElijahCraig.com/friedegg. That's ElijahCraig.com/friedegg. The Fried Egg is brought to you by Elijah Craig, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, Bardstown, Kentucky, 47% alcohol by volume. Elijah Craig reminds you to think wisely and drink wisely. Now back to Roberto Castro. Is there anything with the Players in Sawgrass, is there anything that you think is transferable to Augusta in terms of skills and stuff that you need around Sawgrass?
I would say the shot on 15 at Augusta, a few of the shots at Sawgrass would be a good preparation for it because it's just such a, I mean, that's my favorite golf hole in the world, but being able to hit the correct flight spin and get the correct distance if you have to lay up or if you don't, even if you're going for it in two, but otherwise not really.
Around the greens, is that telling at all? I that's the one thing I was kind of thinking about, is it's pretty severe around the greens at Sawgrass.
No, the reason is, and I was actually going to mention this, I'm glad you brought it up. Augusta is super hilly, and mm-hmm. Sawgrass is dead flat. It's built in a swamp. One thing that's really difficult about Sawgrass that you cannot see on TV is that there's no depth perception and you can't really see what's out there. Like the 16th hole yesterday, when you're hitting that second shot with a 4-iron or a 60-yard wedge shot, it's just railroad ties and horizon and the pin kind of sits there and you don't really have any depth perception of that shot Paul Casey hit. If you hit it a little too far, you feel like you can hit it in the water. Everything being flat doesn't give you like perspective and depth like it does at Augusta. So that's really, really difficult. And a lot of the shots at Sawgrass are visually very tough because you can't really get elevated like the cameras are. You're just sitting on the ground level and there's all this trouble and it's very hard to explain, but it's totally different than the camera view.
when they talk about like when the NCAA championship in basketball, and you go to these huge domes, and they talk about how hard it is shooting because of depth. I imagine it might be similar kind of situation to that.
I think so. I think that your eyes and your eyes give you the feedback that you use. And I had never heard that until a few years ago, but it totally makes sense in basketball, right? You see the hoop there, and then you see the ceiling is generally 80 feet behind the hoop. Then you go play at the Georgia Dome, and the ceiling and the walls are 400 feet behind the hoop. That has to mess with your brain somehow.
So this is, I think, you know, a topic of that parlays kind of in golf architecture, because I always talk about this, is that they're good design has some deception with that when you don't have the natural features, right? Or if you do have the natural features, and there's always the idea of like, you know, for players of the PGA Tour quality, you can know the number. You've got a professional caddy that's telling you the exact number.
Right.
You have even if you have a flat lie, you know, there's some uneven lies created there because of rumples in the fairway, but you have a flat lie, knowing in the back of your mind, there's still that element of feel and in something not looking right, or there's maybe not a full trust in what the number is because of what your eyes are telling you has a big impact on your shot.
Yep. Number four at Sawgrass is the only elevation change on the course. That shot is a three wood. Every player in that field can hit 10 three woods in a row on a blanket on the driving range. But that tee sits up about 10 yards, and I bet 8 out of 10 guys would say that's the most awkward shot on the golf course. You see guys flare it into the tree right off the tee box. You see guys hit whip hooks up onto the left hill over there. It's a three wood. But visually, it's something about the design being elevated makes that shot really, really difficult. And the only explanation is the feel and how it looks to the eye.
That, I mean, think about last year when Westy hit it a mile right and Bryson topped his three wood on that hole.
He topped his three wood, yes. That is such a terrifying tee shot. And if you went and played it on a Tuesday morning with your buddies, you would think nothing of it. There's nothing to that shot, except it's the hardest shot on the golf course somehow.
Something I think about so much that you talked about the first time you were on the pod was the idea of like, if you're going to the first tee, the last club that you want to have to hit is your three wood, because that's where you can look really silly. And that moment, the fourth hole last year, like it just like illuminated that and then I've started to think about it more and more. You think about like the viral moments where tour players hit really bad shots. Harold Varner topping it at Riviera was a three wood. You know, Francesco Molinari at, I think, Pebble this year topped a three wood. Like, it's like that's the one club where we see really, really bad misses. And it makes me think back to like my high school golf days.
Yeah.
Of standing on the first tee when the driver head was a little bit smaller and really worrying about pop-ups, snap hooks, and all sorts of bad shots, which is probably why I wasn't the number one guy on my high school team.
No, and it circles back to what we were talking about at the beginning. What is a three wood today? It's a smaller head that spins more. It's a driver from the 1980s or the 1990s. So if you want to bring more excitement and more, you know, variety to golf, you can do the ball or you could do something with the driver. But absolutely. And like the ninth hole at Greensboro is another slightly elevated tee. And if the weather's warm, I hit like 3 iron down there and hit 8 iron in. And you see some guys hit driver like way up over the bunker. But the last club I want to hit there is a three wood. One year I hit three wood off a house that's not even in play over there, and it kicked back in play. But if I hit a driver, it doesn't spin enough for me to like flare it into the house. And if I hit 3 iron, I mean, it's going to be reasonably down the fairway. Three wood is the absolute scariest club.
It really makes the point of, you know, what you talked about with the wind and how you saw these clubs that guys were hitting into greens. It kind of makes the point, if there was the ability to get variable golf balls that almost acted the way altitude acts, where,
right,
you know, you could have, because there are benefits to the May players, right? The golf course is firmer. The weather's generally a little bit better, more reliable.
Yeah, on site, it's way better. The party vibe and the spectators in May were amazing because it's 90 degrees. College kids were back from, it was a totally different vibe and an awesome one in May.
More daylight too, for just getting the field around. We always see the darkness delays, weather, you know, not weather dependent, but you know, like it makes the case of this variable, a variable golf ball where, you know, like you see these guys, they're playing at Chapultepec. Back. It's like, they go down there, they spend a day hitting TrackMan, and the altitude's not a big deal. You weren't seeing guys blow it 20 yards over greens and come up 15 yards short. They figure it out. And if you could create a ball that reacts similar, but yeah, is variable based off of like, oh, we can take 10% off this week. We can add, you know, certain places you play the full juiced up ball. If you're going to play, you know, Kiowa Island, like that maybe that's a course that you don't need, like, you don't need to have a reduced ball. But when you go to Sawgrass, a place that like there's not a ton of space to add to it, a lot of those hazards, those diagonal hazards that cut across fairways have become, you know, hey, you're a long hitter, you don't need to hit driver. March certainly helps with more right. drivers. But, you know, the idea of keeping that integrity and seeing guys hit shots, it makes a ton of sense because we saw it play out on Saturday.
Yeah.
So any other big takeaways for you from the players?
Not really. I thought that, why were so many like short putts being missed and like 360 spin outs? I thought that was a little strange. I have a question for you though. All these, yeah, it's the fried egg. Who's going to play all these new golf courses that are being built? There's so many of these destination courses with the cottages being built. Am I crazy? Is there a bubble? What is going on?
You know, it's good for, you know, somebody that writes about golf courses to have a bubble, you know, but I would say this is a good segue. I think there's a little bit of an Ahoopy effect going on with some of these places.
Yeah.
Where Mike Walrath, who's obviously the owner of Ahoopy, a lot of like very wealthy people go there. They see what this guy has, like his own effective playground. And they want one. And obviously, you know, the stock market did quite well through COVID. And it was a situation where the rich got richer. And, you know, I think that's led to some of it, where I think the idea also, like with just the last 5-6 years, you know, golf courses and architectures become more popular. And I think one of the things is that architects, in a way, have become a little bit more accessible, and people have started to understand like, oh, like, you know, building a great golf course isn't that crazy. Like, I just need to get one of these guys, right? But I think there's also a market reaction. This is a good question. There's a lot of layers to this. To, you know, they see what the Kaisers and then, you know, what Streamsong and Pinehurst does. And it's effectively like the same model, but on a private level, right? They've just mimicked the model, right? We're going to build a great golf course. It's going to be a destination. But you start to add up the cost of going to Streamsong in December, and you compare it to the cost of going to, you know, if you can get onto Ahoopy. And sometimes you do the math and it's like, well, Ahoopy's actually cheaper than Streamsong because they aren't going to ding me $9 for a Miller Lite. And so for people that aren't aware, is Ahoopy has a daily buy-in is the model. Like I spend, I think it's around $1,000, and that's everything. That's all my food. That's all the golf I want to play, everything. Now you go to Streamsong and you're spending $300-$400 for a room, $300 or so for golf, and then you add the food in, which is really expensive there, and you're right at $1,000. So I think that's the thing, is that it's just resorts are financially incentivized to be the innovators in the industry. The people with the most ability to innovate and should be most incentivized are municipalities, but they're the last ones to do it, unfortunately. But then, like, so you see, like, the short course boom. It starts at resorts. Then it gets passed down to clubs building, converting these 5 acres into short courses, like all over the place, private clubs. And eventually short courses probably are just now, like you're just starting to see them in municipalities. I know there's the one up in Minneapolis that Ben Warren and a group are building, Chaska 9. Like it's a short course. Like I think that's the reality of the situation, right? Is like the resort set that, so if you see trends from resorts, a couple years later, it's going to come to private clubs, and we're at this spot where this is a really long answer. I feel like I've been talking for like an hour, but you know, this private getaway golf is just a knee jerk react, and not a knee jerk, but a reaction to what the Kaisers and other destination golf's been doing.
Yeah, I'm curious to watch it play out because obviously, when things cycle down. Even these owners, you got these like billionaire owners, you know, like they're not really affected by recessions. But long term, you know, their family takes over. Do they want to run a golf course that operates at a loss? There's a lot to unpack there, but it just feels like there are so many. There are so many of those. And maybe there's demand. Like you said, the 1% of people can get on a hoopie. I mean, less. It's 1/100 of 1% have access to a place like that. So the rest of us are calling Stream Song and they're booked 14 months in advance.
Well, that's the thing. Bandon's accepting reservations in 2024. They're booked until then. It's a crazy. So like this is a supply and demand situation in a way, right?
Yeah.
I think that I always say this, like I think where people are missing the boat a little bit is building new courses, and I think it's a little bit harder, but there's a lot of great golf courses that people don't know are great golf courses that are available for a lot less money than building a new course. But like I mean you also talk to a guy like I think you know Mike Young, right?
Yes, yeah, from LaGrange. Yep.
Yeah, he tells me all the time. Like he obviously the Fields is like an hour from Atlanta, hour 15, hour and a half from Atlanta. Right. But he gets guys that come in and they fly into Atlanta and they go to Sweetens and they go to the Fields and then they drive all the way across the state to Aiken Golf Club. You know, and that's their trip. It's like they hit those three places and it's like you probably drive by a lot of good golf courses on the way to those that, you know, would make your life a little bit easier. But this destination golf, like people are driving. And I always use this, like people fly to Portland to go to breweries. You know, right. This is not crazy. People like this is kind of where the society is going. I always, though, say that it's way better when you can do a golf trip. And this is why I'm such a big fan of like Grand Rapids. There's a lot of good golf in San Francisco too. Like when you can do a golf trip to a major metropolitan, I think that it's the same thing. If you can fly into a city and play clubs around the city, which not a lot of people can do, that's a way better experience than going to these remote areas because there's actually like culture and things to do off the course to experience. Right.
Right. And I can see where they're getting members too for these new projects because 5 years ago, you had, let's say, a handful of destination private clubs, and you could get called on pretty easily, unaccompanied, or somebody would host you. And now the tee sheets are so slammed that they've all restricted a lot of guest play. And it's just harder to say, hey, you know, you're a member at Secession. Can I get 8 guys on over? They're sold out. They don't want you over there. And so if I'm getting the Heisman for a lot of these private clubs, and I hear there's a new one coming up and somewhere nearby there in Buford, I'm interested in joining because I want to be the guy that says, hey, I just joined this club. Let's take eight guys over to this destination private club. So, but we'll see. But it's interesting. The private local clubs have shifted more towards the family. The target member for these new destination clubs is your 55 empty nester has time to travel, right? So 20 years from now, that person is retired and not looking to travel 2 weekends a month to their. So all these things have a life cycle and a target membership, and how it evolves to me is very fascinating.
I think there's something to about parenting, and I think about I can't ever compare myself anymore to the target market, right? But
right.
I think the expectation and the role of dual parents has changed a lot where for a lot of people, the idea of being a member of a club that they go to a couple times a year, maybe twice, say two trips a year,
right,
is a lot more palatable to, you know, their partner and their family than the idea of a place that you spend every weekend at all year round. And I think that's one of the things that these clubs present, is that there is a person that's a national member of club, and whether it's destination or an out of town club, that is actually not a member of a club in their hometown.
Sure.
If that makes sense. Because you've got kids sport, youth sports, you've got all these things, you've got your job. And, you know, the only time you can really go play golf is if you depart, you know, your responsibility.
Yeah, I agree. We talk about this a lot on my Business of Golf podcast, and it's utilization.
Everybody should listen. It's good to listen. I like the variety of topics. I was going to give a plug on the intro, but yeah.
Shameless plug, the Course Record Show. But we talk about it all the time, and I think if things normalize a little bit and tee sheets aren't so packed, and I don't know if this involves NFTs or Web3 or whatever, all that stuff is a little above my pay grade. But I think there's a VRBO model to be used in golf with these private destination clubs. So you just mentioned, I join a destination club. I go three times a year, take my buddies. Like you said, we peel off for three weekends a year. I pay every month for that club. Why shouldn't I get 40 times a month that I can then go sell on some sort of marketplace? And not palatable right now because everyone's club is sold out. But when... if it gets overbuilt or if there's some slack in demand, I think a Airbnb VRBO model in golf is really appealing. I really do. I think there's long-term utilization is something we talk about on our podcast all the time. And I think it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. You're giving away free business ideas, right? You know,
Castro Golf Consulting. That's what we did. Preferably not for free, but occasionally for free.
There's a new course that Ogilvy and Mike Cocking and Ashley Mead are building, and Minnesota has an interesting model from what I've read just in news article. I haven't talked to anybody, any of the owners about it, but from what I gleaned from an article is that if you're a member, you get effectively like 100 golf days, and you can send four people. That so, you know, if you sent a foursome of your buddies up there, you can do that, but that would take up, you know, that would take up four of your 100 golf days, if that makes sense. I was when Zach Blair was figuring out his model at the tree farm, I'm a procrastinator. I might decide that I want to go do something a week ahead of time.
That's the whole point of being a member of a private club.
And all these destination places are built for type A planners, which I think is like probably the vast majority of golfers or members, you know, affluent golfers. But like I want something that's geared towards me, that it's like, you know what, maybe you can't make a tee time. And, you know, maybe if you want to plan 6 months out, we say no.
Right.
Tee sheets closed. Like, I don't know. It doesn't work for a destination because you got to get there. Right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, that destination doesn't work for somebody who's not, you know, really focused on what their day looks like 6 months in the future.
Sure. And that fundamentally you have, let's say 500 members and 180 people can play golf in a day, or 200. So you're going to have some disappointed people if everyone wants to play. So there's no easy answer. But I think from what I've read about Zach's model, I'm watching closely. I watch all these things. I mean, that's what we talk about on our pod, is business side of it. I think he's underestimating how much people are going to want to come to the tree farm in the spring and fall, and how little people are going to want to come in August and January. And how do you flatten that out, especially when you're capped at 48 people on property? That's the thing, is you get a perfect day in April, you can run 160 golfers through a golf course, but not if you can only put 48 people on property. And how he's going to handle that, I think, is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting for Aiken in general, just with, you know, the added golf courses. And yeah. I think, you know, I've heard there's just a ton of stuff going on down in your neck of the woods in general. People have discovered the South Carolina, Georgia sand vein. And, you know, for it, since you're so interested in golf development, there's going to be a lot of it going on down by you in the next couple of years, because a land's cheap you know, what a Hoopie did was opened everybody's eyes that, hey, it can dump rain for you can dump 3 inches of rain and you go out there 20 minutes after it rains and you still hear that hollow thud.
Yeah. And it's a 12 month season. It is. Can be cold and nasty in January, February, but you can always play. And if you drink 1,000 Gatorades in August, you'll survive. It's hot, but it's hot everywhere. It's hot in the Midwest in August. So it's it really is a 12-month season.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, now a little diversion. We got variety in this podcast. Where can people find your course record show? This is the Course Record Show. It's at wherever you get this podcast, you can get your podcast. And then, you know, also you got your consulting business, Castro Golf Consulting, and then you're the senior advisor at CapTech Consulting. What do you get to do there?
That's right. CapTech Consulting is IT technology consulting, but also has carved out a cool practice in sports. So we are the official digital technology provider of PGA of America, PGA Championship, and do work for a few other sports and a few other organizations in golf and beyond. So I spend most of my time with CapTech on real business, and then Castro Golf does design and merchandise, and then CourseRecordShow.com, where we pontificate on the business of golf. And that is on Spotify, Apple Pods, all the places you listen to this esteemed fried egg show.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. We will be back later this week. Big thanks to Meg Atkins, who edited this podcast. As a reminder, check out the Pro Shop. We're starting to stock up stuff. We're getting some new things in there. And, you know, we're getting close to golf season. So support the Fried Egg. Great way to do that is through the Pro Shop. So it's proshop.thefriedegg.com. We got polos, hats, a bunch of other things. We got prints if you're into photography. A lot of great prints up there. I think we're over 60 courses now. It's a great way to dress up your man cave or your office. And we'll be back Friday. So thank you, and we will talk soon.